Harper's Magazine, April 2025. Under fiction, titled Cocktail Hour. By Neil Zink from Sister Europe, which was published last month by Knopf. Demian was among the first guests to arrive, taking a taxi. He had intended to get through the evening by being buzzed, though he managed only one glass of wine at home. He had to arrive early if he were to have a fighting chance of drinking two aperitifs before dinner without looking like a lush. The hotel had been updated in the 70s, but the original building was vintage 1958. And the decor suggested a more prosperous USSR, where L. Lisinski could work in gold leaf. The reception desk faced the entrance. Quite close to it, with the lobby stretching sideways, long and narrow. Before he could even say hello, he heard Masoud's voice from behind him. The writer was seated in a group of four that occupied two upholstered sofas and two chairs, half hidden by a Madeleine-esque screen fashioned from dully gleaming brass rods and large oblongs of polished agate. He beckoned with expansive gesture for Demian to approach. Quote, "Good evening," unquote, Demian said. Maud stood to embrace him lightly and trade air kisses. Demian knew him well. Masoud was celebrated as the literary voice of Greater Arabia's nomadic herdsmen, proud sons of the desert, a noble caste of unhurried Cypriots, not known for their religious orthodoxy. He had fled the Sinai for Norway at the age of 11, but wrote with unabated, prolific intensity about his youth, and had never attained a literary competence in a second language. Masoud introduced the woman sitting next to him as his wife, Ibisam. She wore a short black cape, Demian guessed Chloe, over a long black gown, with coral jewelry and lipstick, counteracting her petite stature with her vertiginous lubantins. A black scarf framed her small white face. She said good evening to Demian without extending her hand to be shaken. Her modest attire was very much at odds with her husband's avowed secularism. The roly-poly ambassador stood for a handshake. They had met several times before, and Demian remembered to address him as Excellency. The diplomat, a former compressed natural gas sales rep from an excellent family, radiated self-satisfied prosperity, not least in his lavishly wavy, gloriously auburn choice of toupee. The fourth, a younger man, leaned back in his seat and lifted his highball glass, saying in greeting, quote, "You'll have some whiskey," end quote. It was a jarringly blasé, almost rude command. Demian resolved to gloss over the awkwardness by asking whether the princess had come down yet. Quote, "She's at home," the young man said. "I'm her grandson, Radi," end quote. "Enchanté," he said, surprised. Quote, "I mean, I'm very sorry to hear it. I hope she gets well soon," end quote. They shook hands and he took a seat on Masoud's sofa. The ambassador diverted his friends from the odd scene by telling a joke. Quote, "A Bedouin and a Chinese walk into a bar," he said. "The Chinese orders nothing. The Bedouin says that nothing is good enough. The bartender gives the Bedouin a triple of single malt on the house and slaps the Chinese in the face," end quote. Masoud and Ibtisam laughed. Radi groaned. Demian, unsure what he had just heard and who had slapped the Chinese person, said somewhat tentatively, quote, "And then the Chinese does what?" End quote. Still laughing, Masoud says, quote, "It's a fable. The Chinese has been to this bar many times, but he never orders anything." End quote. Quote, "I'm sorry," Demian said. "I thought it was meant to be a joke." End quote. His implication that he had taken the joke seriously occasioned great general hilarity. The ambassador, once he was done laughing, explained to himself with the air of a man condescending to a woman. Quote, "The Chinese are generous investors, but they import workers who are not well paid. I much prefer the German." End quote. Leaning back, Masoud declaimed in tones of dulcet sagacity, quote, "It's best when builders are not creative." End quote. There was a moment of silence. Demian wondered whether he was making an ethnic joke about Germans or recalling the earthquake that had devastated Turkey and Syria 2 weeks before. Ibtisam clarified the issue by looking down mournfully, although she said not a word. The lull allowed the ambassador to change the subject. He asked Masoud what he was working on. Quote, "A feminist story," end quote, the great writer replied. Quote, "Wonderful," the ambassador cried, as though in transports. Quote, "How does it go?" End quote. Quote, "A sheik's son by a slave woman," end quote. The writer looked around meaningfully, lowering his voice as though the son in question were there in the lobby, and leaned toward the others so that they leaned in as well. Quote, "Was walking home from delivering a message, following the shore of the sea, when he saw a young woman lying naked on the sand. He approached and saw that she had come from the sea dead, but very beautiful, not swollen and torn," end quote. It was apparent that he intended to tell the entire story. Demian liked it already, because the drowned woman had remained beautiful. So much of life was ugly and cruel. Why shouldn't stories be different? He would find other opportunities to talk to Radi about architecture. Quote, "It could only be a work of witchcraft," Masoud said. Quote, "He gathered acacia wood to build a fire to burn her. But when he put her on the fire, she reawakened to life. Her body burned away. There was no skeleton or meat inside, only a beautiful woman made of flame. She sat upright and spoke with him. She told stories of her homeland, a forested place of great fertility, where cows graze on green savanna and the faithful live in bliss. The flames began to die down and she grew smaller. He did not want to part with her, so he added wood to the fire. He went into the wadi and cut down trees to burn. In the end, he stayed awake for 10 nights talking to her, until there was no tree left in all the surrounding wadis. He burned thorn bushes, and he gathered every herb that grew to burn it. Then he burned his cloak and his shirt and his head covering. He cut off his hair to burn it. There was nothing left, and the woman began to fade. She said, quote, "There is only one way to keep me, and that is to join me in the fire," end quote. Naked, just like her, with only his dagger, he stepped into the fire and closed his eyes. The fire was so small that sweat of his fear put it out. When he opened his eyes, the woman stood by him. She took his hand and they began to walk toward his home. When they arrived, he asked his mother for clothing for himself and the woman. Quote, "What woman?" end quote, his mother said. "She cannot see her. but he saw her clearly and heard her speaking, telling of paradise. He sat in his mother's tent all day listening to her. He stopped speaking to other people, always listening to her. His parents were troubled that their son had been driven mad by a witch. His father invited all the nobility of the region to a large festival to take place for 3 days, during which there would be much loud music and shouting. He forced his son to come with him to the center of the crowd, by the fire, where he could not hear the woman if she spoke, or see her because it was so bright, and he said to him, quote, "Your witch is dead. We have killed her," end quote. The boy looked to the fire, knowing that his love could not die. He saw her standing in the flames. He ran to her. Because he was not naked, his clothes caught fire and burned his skin terribly. The woman of flame cried out, but quickly she put on his clothing of flame and seized his dagger, and when she stepped out of the fire, she was dressed as a young man. All who saw this happen were frozen with amazement, and she melted away into the crowd, invisible to all because she did not speak. A woman is visible only when she speaks. End quote. Masood gave a little bow, acknowledging the others' nods. Demian decided, after brief consideration, that the last bit might be feminist. Radi prompted Masood, quote, "So what happens next?" End quote. Quote, "Dressed as a man, armed with a dagger, she approached her lover's father in his tent and said, quote, "Now that I possess human life and strength, you must die for the crime of murdering my lover," end quote. He asked, quote, "Who are you?" Quote, quote, "I am Emir's daughter," she said, "sold as a slave. From the trader's ship I threw myself into the sea, filling my lungs with water so that I fell straight to the bottom of the sea. I found that I could live there, but I was alone. I walked slowly along the bottom of the sea, where it was dark, calling out, but no one answered me. After a time I came to a reef, and I walked upward through the corals. There were enormous sponges and urchins with long spines. Fish shaped like barrels, and fish shaped like ropes in all colors. It was very beautiful, but there were no people in the sea, and I was alone there. I came out to lie down on the shore, but there were no people on land, and I could no longer breathe air. I had lost my life of air and my life of water. I could breathe only earth and fire. I was very close to death when your son found me. He could have buried me, letting me breathe earth, but he chose fire. I owe him both my lives," end quote. Quote, "Very well," the sheik said. "I still have all my 4 lives, so kill me if you can," end quote. He felt no fear, because he wore an enchanted robe that would turn back steel. But her lover had told her his father's secret, so she plunged the dagger into his eye. He fell down on his back and died," end quote. Masood paused for effect. Quote, "She removed her slave boy's clothes and put on the enchanted robe that would turn back steel. She walked her way through the camp, with the swords of all the tribesmen bouncing off her arms and legs. Her dead lover's brother, a boy of 4 years old, saw the many spears bouncing off her back as she left the camp, and he wanted to play as well. He had a little bow and some arrows tipped with thorns and fish bones. He took aim at the center of her back and hit her there. A slight wound, enough to drive 1 thread of the enchanted cloak into her skin. invulnerability spread from the wounds for a hand span in all directions, an unaccustomed condition for human flesh, causing a burning pain. She reached back to feel the arrow lodged in her clothing. She turned around, and the little boy fired another arrow that hurt her in her heart. She started to run. When she came to a wadi, she tripped and fell, and her mouth filled with dust. Without fire for her to breathe, she died. End quote. Roddy said, quote, seriously? End quote. Quote, her evil was ended through the wisdom of a child, end quote, Masood confirmed. Quote, she would have been a good match for her lover, who required an organ donation. But the surgeons were unable to acquire tissue, because even her epidermis was invulnerable to steel. When the surgeons finally opened her with a piece of broken glass, the putrefaction was as warm as life. Because she was an evil demon, they threw her into the sea. Dying taught her how to be quiet. When she arrived at the bottom of the sea, she did not feel alone anymore, because she had learned to make herself invisible and to listen. End quote. Deciding that the story was definitely not feminist, Demian looked at his watch. Only a few minutes had passed, but somehow his drink was empty. He didn't remember drinking it. Quote, that story doesn't sound Bedouin to me, end quote, Roddy said to Masood. Quote, it reminds me of Vikings, especially the misogyny and the burial by fire. Like Idan Fadam's account of the Kievan Rus. Didn't you grow up in Norway? End quote. Harper's Magazine, April 2025. Under Poem. Title, Plates of Fruit, Cotton Peeled. By David Swang from Silkworms Pessori, which was published last month by The Song Cave. Persimmons on a leafless tree. Unlaid eggs in a butchered hen. The old woman picks from the sagging branch. The grandson skips a stone. It rejects the pond three times, as if it belonged on that far shore. Harper's Magazine, April 2025, under Miscellany, title, The Last Detail, On Patrol with the Guardian Angels, by Kent Russell. When I moved to New York City in 2008, I carried with me a dog-eared copy of Jane Jacobs' Death and Life of Great American Cities. I was relocating from Florida with a Civitas with thin on the ground, and I had grand dreams of putting down roots in a lively neighborhood where my civic spiritedness could bloom. I wanted to be a real citizen, you understand. I can't say that the transformation ever happened in the intervening decade and a half. I lived in, but was not of, Washington Heights, Inwood, Flatbush. That my local community should be the nexus of my public affections, I still believe this. I just never put that belief into practice. I didn't even like going to the farmer's market. I developed a rationalization for this inertia. By letting these neighborhoods be, I was preserving them as they were. What possible benefit could I, a transplant and a gentrifier, have brought to deepest Brooklyn? Better that I interact with these communities like a thoughtful conservationist, leaving no trace as I passed on through. In time, I got married. I grew up a bit. My wife and I settled into life on West 84th Street, where we read The West Side Rag, volunteered at our local church, and carried on a mystifying and possibly sexually charged acquaintanceship with the bodega guy. Or at least I did. Lately, my wife and I have also begun to lament the decline of the knob, which has become categorically grodier since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. The decline of the nabe, N-A-B-E. Contra my previous rationalization, I now understood that leaving a neighborhood alone meant leaving it open to a torrent of change. In the same way that I must repaint my window box to keep it evergreen and not soot black, so would I have gotten involved in my neighborhood's upkeep if I wanted it to remain a nice place to raise a kid. I was thinking along these lines one summer day while strolling the Coney Island boardwalk with my wife. We were discussing our future in the city, what it might look like, what sacrifices it would entail once baby made three. As we walked hand in hand, my eye was drawn to a moisture-bloated printout pasted to a lamppost. Guardian Angels. There was an image of a winged eye of providence, as well as Precis. Quote, "The Guardian Angels is a volunteer subway and street patrol serving New York City since 1979. Our presence helps to deter crime and keep our city safe." End quote. Following the group's contact information, an imploration. Dare to care. Now, the Guardian Angels, as I knew from pop culture, as a punchline. There was supposed to be a bunch of overeager goons in red berets who did more harm than good when they tried to foil a purse snatching or a citizen's arrest a jaywalker. But I'd never actually seen one in real life. I guess I had assumed they'd ceased operations years ago. Judging from the state of the flyer, they might have. On any other day, I would have found their motto to be cringe-inducing, in the manner of McGruff, the crime dog. Somehow, though, Dare to Care resonated with me. I thought back to the subway odyssey my wife and I had just undertaken. 90 minutes, 3 transfers, and 2 discreet, yet indiscreet, gentlemen who had stalked our train car shouting threats and counter-threats at each other. Knowing the drill, my wife and I lowered our eyes and entered a disassociative fugue. There on the boardwalk, I thought to myself, we shouldn't have to live like this. I was unhappy with the state of public order in New York City. Who wasn't? But I sided with neither the left nor the right when it came to solutions. We had tried radical leniency, and that wasn't working. Yet I didn't think a glut of cops would fix things either. The idealist in me believed subsidiarity was worth a shot. Ordinary people at the hyperlocal level deciding not to ignore dysfunction, refusing to allow it to metastasize. After all, if it is axiomatic that citizens of a democratic society must govern themselves, then they must govern their public spaces too. And wasn't that what the Guardian Angels were all about? That evening, I emailed them. When my message yielded no reply, I called their headquarters. The line was disconnected. I tried messaging their Facebook pages. Nada. A week passed before I received an email instructing me to contact the leader of the Upper West Side and Hell's Kitchen Patrol, a woman named Julie. On the phone, Julie asked why I wanted to join the Angels. I told her I was daring to care. This sufficed. The phone interview was, I believe, a rudimentary psych evaluation. So long as I didn't say, quote, the streets are extended gutters and the gutters are full of blood, and when the drains finally scab over, all the vermin will drown, end quote, I passed. Julie explained that her chapter usually patrolled the west side of Manhattan once a week, most often Wednesday or Thursday night, for a couple of hours. They stick to the streets when the weather permits, they tour the subway when it's cold and or precipitating, and they provide security at a certain municipal events. I was welcome to join them at the upcoming San Gennaro Festival in Little Italy. I could consider it a ride-along, Julie said. In order to understand the Guardian Angels, one has to first understand their founder and talisman, Curtis Sliwa. Sliwa is many things. A 70-year-old gadfly, a blowhard of the old school, and a New Yorker's New Yorker. He has been in the public eye for more than half a century. Most recently, Sliwa could be seen getting handcuffed at a number of protests against the influx of asylum seekers into New York City. Before that, in 2021, he led a brash and deeply weird campaign for the mayoralty against Eric Adams, in which he got trounced. Sliwa has been a talk radio host for 3 decades. He lives in a 320-square-foot studio apartment with 16 rescue cats and his 4th wife. Sliwa's 3rd wife is reportedly suing him for more than $530,000 in unpaid child support. She has also alleged that he cheated on her with the Queens District Attorney. In other words, although Sliwa is an incredibly charismatic man, he's a man of greater enterprise than discretion. Sliwa was born in the Canarsie section of Brooklyn in 1954 to a Polish-American father and an Italian-American mother. She finagled a spot for her son on Romper Room when he was 6, at which point, quote, Curtis was very impressed by his brief experience with fame, end quote, according to the author James Haskins' 1983 history of the organization. In high school, Sliwa happened upon a burning house while working his newspaper route. For helping rescue several people, he was presented with an award by Mayor John Lindsay and was invited to the White House to shake hands with Richard Nixon. It was around this time that he developed a reputation as a brawler and earned himself a nickname, quote, The Rock, end quote. It was a reputation that would serve him well when he was hired as an assistant manager of a McDonald's in the Bronx of 1978. This was the Bronx of the, quote, benign neglect, end quote, years, many parts of it violent and anarchic. In his telling, Sliwa encountered crime everywhere. Inspired by the vigilante heroes of films like Taxi Driver and Death Wish, and by the gang epic The Warriors, Sliwa put together a crime-fighting brigade drawn from local volunteers. He outfitted them in white T-shirts, because they were cheap, and red berets, because they would stand out in a crowd. For the brigade's symbol, Sliwa decided on an eye of providence to represent vigilance. He dubbed these volunteers his, quote, Magnificent 13, end quote. And they performed their inaugural subway patrol in February 1979. They rode the so-called Mugger's Express, the number 4 IRT train that ran from Woodlawn in the Bronx down through Manhattan and onto Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. According to Sliwa, he had to, quote, brainwash, end quote, the members of his original crew, who worried they would get killed on the job. He also went to lengths to make sure the group was racially diverse. The group, as Haskin recounts, was, quote, prepared to sacrifice their lives if necessary, end quote, according to the press release composed by Sliwa and distributed to local media outlets by his mother. Quote, in the same spirit that our nation's forefathers resisted the tyranny of the crown, so shall we resist the tyranny of fear that rules our subways, end quote. Sliwa forbade the carrying of weapons. If his group came across a crime in progress, they would alert the transit police or make a citizen's arrest if they thought they could do so safely. But their primary goal was deterrence. Sliwa hoped that the mere presence of his magnificent 13 would force petty criminals to think twice before snatching a woman's necklace or rolling a drunk. That first night, according to the group's own reports, they thwarted a mugging on 167th Street and River Avenue in the Bronx. They restrained the assailant, alerted the train's conductor, and handed the mugger over to police officers. The Magnificent 13 reported more heroics as they patrolled nightly from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. One volunteer suffered a broken arm in the line of duty. Another, with Sliwa alongside him, rescued a subway clerk who had fallen onto the tracks at Union Square. News of these exploits spread, and soon Sliwa was flooded with eager applicants. He vetted them carefully, by his own account turning down more than he accepted. Prospects had to have a job or be enrolled in school. They had to be physically capable, and they had to show equanimity in the face of abuse. They had to be zealous, but not overzealous. Sliwa didn't want anyone coming in with a grudge. By late April, 13 had become 48. By May, they were featured in Time. Soon they had a new name, the Guardian Angels. Bad press followed good. Many city officials remained skeptical. They thought the Angels a reckless mob of vigilantes and attention hounds. Sliwa organized a 3-day hunger strike at City Hall to protest the mayor's refusal to credit the Guardian Angels with the rescue of a transit officer from an attack at Bowling Green subway station. Eventually, the civil authorities softened their stance somewhat. Even the New York Times endorsed the Angels, sort of. Quote, guiding this spontaneous and admittedly risky movement to constructive service is simply another challenge to New York. It certainly beats the alternative, leaving restless but organized youth to make trouble. End quote. That year, 1981, the Angels' ranks had reportedly swelled to nearly 1,000. Sliwa had long since quit his job at McDonald's and was supporting himself with the help of friends and relatives while directing Angel patrols from a telephone booth at Manhattan's Columbus Circle subway station. The relationship between the Guardian Angels and the police was fractious to begin with and remained so. In 1980, following months of low-level scuffles, Sliwa was approached at a subway station in the Bronx by 3 off-duty transit cops, who kidnapped him and dumped him in Long Island with a warning about the Angels taking their jobs. An investigation into the kidnapping conducted by the Bronx District Attorney produced no suspects. The president of the Transit Patrolmen's Benevolent Association scoffed at the story, according to Haskins' account, saying, quote, Curtis Sliwa knows by heart the phone numbers of every newspaper, radio, and television station, reporter, and editor in the city. It seems incredible that he should not remember the license plate of the car or the badge numbers of the officers. End quote. Early the following year, around a dozen on-duty guardian angels were arrested by the transit police on assorted charges of riot, assault, and resisting arrest. Not long after, the Office of the Mayor announced the signing of a memorandum of understanding by the guardian angels, the NYPD, and the transit police that would allow all parties to, quote, work together cooperatively, end quote. In August 1981, Slewa was kidnapped again, this time in Washington. According to news reports at the time, he was walking near Washington Monument late at night when three men identifying themselves as police officers approached him and detained him for several hours, during which time Slewa was beaten and then tossed into the Potomac River. The case fell under jurisdiction of the U.S. Park Service, which could neither corroborate Slewa's story nor locate any suspects. A decade later, Slewa admitted to the New York Post that he had lied about this incident and several others, including his first kidnapping, in order to juice publicity for the Angels during their early years. Slewa remains adamant that neither he nor his Angels have faked anything since. Their raids on crack houses in the 80s and 90s were legit, as were at least a few of their interrupted muggings. When a responding officer mistook the Newark Angel Frank Melvin for a burglar and shot him in the chest in 1981, that was real. As were the shooting deaths of Juan Oliva in the Bronx in 1983 and Sherman Geiger in Yonkers in 1987. According to the organization, six angels have been killed in action and 36 seriously injured. Slewa is one of them, and he has the wounds to prove it. In June 1992, he was shot several times at point-blank range in the back of a New York taxicab during an attempted mob hit orchestrated by the Gambino crime family. Slewa hailed the cab around dawn on his way to the WABC radio studios, at which point a gunman emerged from under the dashboard, quote, like a jack-in-the-box, end quote, according to Slewa. Quote, take this, you son of a bee, quote, end quote. Slewa recalled the gunman saying before plugging him with hollow-point bullets. Realizing that the cab's door handles were missing, Slewa said he sprang from the back seat, quote, like a trampoline, end quote, launching himself past the gunman and halfway through the open front passenger window. Stuck and flailing, Slewa's clothing snagged the bumper of a parked car, and he was yanked onto the street, barely conscious, but miraculously alive. John A. Gotti, the mafia family's scion, was later charged with ordering the hit in response to Slewa's radio show trolling of his father, the late John J. Gotti. A patsy was charged with the attempted murder. Even then, Slewa was viewed as less than sympathetic by many New Yorkers. Gotti's defense attorney argued that Slewa might have fabricated the details of the incident. Quote, short of death, end quote, the attorney asked Slewa, quote, is there anything that will stop you from giving a press conference, end quote. Today, the Guardian Angels claim chapters in 13 countries and more than 100 cities. This is a bold claim and a dubious one because the federated structure of the Angels makes it easy to start a chapter and easy to let one go dormant. Also, record-keeping has never been the Angels' strong suit. When Slewa was asked early on for a list of the 92 culprits the group had supposedly placed under citizens' arrest over the years, neither he nor his lawyer, Murray Schwartz, could produce a single name. The group's headquarters, once located in Times Square, is now registered at the modest Carnassi home Sliwa was raised in. Though he still sports his red beret, Sliwa's involvement in the Angels has waned as his political ambitions have waxed. Day-to-day operations are coordinated via WhatsApp by his second-in-command, Arnaldo Salinas. Patrols are carried out under the discretion of deputized leaders like Julie. And membership. Membership is open to all comers, it would appear. I was to meet Julie at 7:30 p.m. at the southwest corner of Mulberry and Houston Streets in front of the REI. The Angels were easy to spot. Six of them milled around the adventure store in red berets and glimmering sateen jackets. I recognized Julie because I had Googled her, a tall, thin, curly-haired woman who accented her Mediterranean features with bold makeup. Julie, who was raised upstate, had worked for decades as a professional organizer. Prior to that, she was a nanny for the well-to-do. She was inordinately proud of her neighborhood, Hell's Kitchen, and a fan of the hashtag, tag, I live in hell. Tonight she wore big boots and her posture was bad, like a slack bowstring. Once I presented myself, Julie handed me a white Angels t-shirt and a fresh beret. Then she introduced me to the crew. There was KC, a squat and bespeckled French bulldog of a woman whose beret was spangled with rainbow flag pins. She had been a guardian angel for 25 years, serving in various positions of authority. She looped a surgical mask around her ears before telling me, quote, I don't do hugs, end quote. We bumped elbows instead. Next, I met Jeff, a densely muscled man with a gray chin-strap beard and a couple of teeth missing from the smile he rarely flashed. Jeff was, by his own admission, quote, an OG, end quote. After him was SK, a lithe and stylish father of two who matched his red glasses to the Angels' gear. Lingering at the edge of the group was Susie, a petite woman with wild, white blonde hair, as well as the spry yet disdainful effect of an inner-city nun. Last was RV, a beefy young man who used to be or still was a bouncer. Our small talk over with, we braced ourselves for patrol. But before we could set off, a woman who looked to be 4'11" in all directions tripped against the curb and ate it hard at my feet. I gaped at her, as is my wont. RV sprang into action, helping the woman up while the rest of the Angels crowded around her, rubbed her back, and offered her water. Quote, Oh my God, I fell in the right place, end quote, the woman exclaimed. Quote, I can't believe this, end quote. She requested a selfie with the Angels, and Julie had to remind me to join the back row. Quote, You'll get that a lot, end quote, Casey told me. Then she instructed me on the finer points of beret care. This was important, she said, because a must beret was viewed as an embarrassment. Quote, She mean you look like spirit Halloween costume, end quote, Jeff clarified. For the next 2 hours, we wriggled through the San Gennaro street fair in a single-file line, combing 11 blocks of Little Italy and then combing them again. I had received no training nor signed any waiver, but I did my best to swivel my head back and forth along a 180-degree ambit like a CCTV camera. stacked chest to back, our column prized apart the crowd of utter borough wise guys, Jersey emigres, street vendors, and tourists. I asked Susie if there was anything particular I should be looking out for. Quote, "Just Julie," end quote, she said. Behind me, Jeff added, quote, "Whatever your leader do, you do," end quote. Festival goers under the age of 40 appeared to be baffled by our presence. I got the sense that they mistook us for an unconventional dance troupe. Those older than 40 were surprised and delighted to see us. They acted as though they had stumbled across a beloved character actor or a species believed to have gone extinct. Quote, "Guys, thanks so much for your service," end quote, one Goomba said to us in passing. Quote, "Curtis, we love Curtis," end quote, others cried out. Some looked up from their caricature long enough to lock eyes and raise a fist. Far and away, the most popular response, though, was a question, quote, "Where's Curtis?" end quote. RV handed out Guardian Angels business cards to our supporters, informing them that Sliwa would be, quote, "re-electing in 2 years," end quote. Casey pulled RV aside to correct him. Quote, "He's running again in 2 years. Remind them to vote," end quote. Casey told me that this was possibly the most pro-Angels crowd I could have encountered on my first night. Quote, "But there's going to be a lot of stuff," end quote, he said. Quote, "You know, verbal abuse. People are going to have a lot of comments. F you as they walk by, drive by, whatever. You need to have that backbone where you don't even think of responding. Do what we call verbal judo. Try to talk people down, but it gets to the point of actual physical contact," end quote. I told her I could handle it. Then I sidled up to Julie. While performatively scanning the thoroughfare for mincing pimps or rowdies in fingerless gloves, I asked her why she joined. She said her interest had been piqued during COVID lockdowns, when residents of Hell's Kitchen requested the presence of the Angels after several violent incidents in the area, and the Upper West Side Patrol stepped in. Julie tracked their progress. Then in 2022, she, quote, "did a patrol like you're doing right now. Then I did another one. Then I was like, yeah, I'm doing this," end quote. She rocketed up the ranks to become patrol leader, at one point the sole female active leader. As Julie readied us to hit the bricks once again, she announced, quote, "I'm going to puke," end quote. The air was too thick with adipose food truck fumes. Susie had to depart. The rest of us patrolled for another 45 minutes, retracing our steps through the festival, feeling kudos and remaining vigilant. At the end of the night, SK asked for one last group photo to complete his set of 12,000. As we posed and smiled, a nasally young guy groaned, quote, "Oh, Jesus, these guys are still around, the Guardian Angels," end quote. I handed over my probationary beret to Julie, promising I'd be back. Before I descended into the Broadway Lafayette Street subway station, I asked to be added to the group chat. What people usually mean when they use the term, quote, "vigilante," end quote, is someone who has taken the law into their own hands. From a legal perspective, vigilanteism is unlawful because it is extrajudicial. From a philosophical perspective, vigilantism is problematic because it is the righting of a wrong by wrongful means. Psychologists have tended to class vigilantes as misguided, if not delusional, individuals who believe their actions are necessary to rectify a structural flaw in society. The rule of law is not functioning as it should. So the vigilante becomes the law, like Batman. His vigilantism is a shadow cast upon society by a failed justice system. According to this line of thinking, two wrongs can make a right, so long as the intent is the restoration of order. The vigilante is acting as an upstanding citizen should. What the vigilante is after is the criminal's just deserts. He wants to turn the tables. He does not want to think of himself as a victim, so he becomes a victimizer. The vigilante rationalizes his actions as self-defense, social defense. Lex Talionis is the ethic of the frontier, do-it-yourself justice, which makes vigilantism American, or American-coded, for better or for worse. What separates vigilantism from self-defense is the spontaneity of the latter and the premeditation of the former. Vigilantes have a target in mind and a plan of action to follow. When Bernhard Goetz shot four men he believed were about to mug him on the two train in 1984, the question of whether he was a vigilante rested upon intent. Why exactly had he brought a .38 caliber handgun onto the train in the first place? Before heading out on my second patrol, I browsed some online archives to see whether the Guardian Angels had supported Bernie Goetz. They had. SLUA had reportedly marched a detachment of angels to the courthouse to offer their services to Goetz as bodyguards. This tarnished their image in the eyes of some New Yorkers, but burnished it for others. If the angels weren't exactly vigilantes themselves, thenceforth they were vigilante adjacent. This was an interesting tact, because a couple of years prior to the Goetz case, SLUA, along with Schwartz, his lawyer, published a book entitled Street Smart, The Guardian Angel Guide to Safe Living. SLUA adopted a reproachful tone toward his reader. Quote, obviously, we, the people who live and work in the cities of America, are to blame. Not so much for the creation of street crime, but for permitting it to continue, for abdicating our responsibility to deal with it. We must understand that we cannot shift the cause of our problems or its cure upon anyone else but ourselves. End quote. As for packing heat in, quote, self-defense, end quote, SLUA was dead set against it. Quote, the use of weapons to protect yourself against punks is not the answer. When we hear someone say, if anyone breaks into my house, I'll shoot him dead, we wonder, why doesn't he say, if someone breaks into my home, he'll never get out of the neighborhood because my neighbors and I are so fed up that we'll grab him for the cops and he will never return again. End quote. In a line that could be read as stance of vigilantes, SLUA concluded that, quote, acting alone, a gunman solves nothing. He cares only about himself and is really out of touch with reality. That is the truth, and Mr. Gun-Toter, we want you to know it. End quote. The angels still forbid members from carrying weapons on patrol, which was fine by me. Adrenalized and afraid, I would misuse mine. The brass knuckles or pocket kosh would almost certainly redound upon my own head and genitals in the event of a brawl. Plus, my years of New York experience had taught me not to engage with shady characters, even when their behavior shifted from erratic to threatening. Better to avert my gaze and wait for the moment to pass. But I was an angel now, I had a white belt in verbal judo. And so, for this reason and others besides, my mouth went acidic with apprehension as I boarded the southbound train to Columbus Circle for my second patrol. Waiting for me outside the station were KC, Jeff, and a fellow named Josh, the erstwhile leader of the Upper West Side Patrol. Josh was about 5'7" and bore striking resemblance to the man himself, Curtis Slewa. The first thing I learned about Josh was that he's a toucher. Every word he spoke came accompanied by a squeeze on the shoulder or a tap on the chest. The second thing I learned about Josh was that he had handed the reins of the patrol to Julie some months prior because, as he put it, he, quote, had some personal issues going on, end quote. I won't speculate as to what those were, and I don't intend to tell tales out of school, but on this patrol, Josh had a hint of the sour mash on his breath. I couldn't fault the guy. I would like three fingers of a Dutch courage myself. Casey gave me a beret to keep. The tag on the inside read, berets.com. And it was at least two sizes too small for me. I was also given my own sateen jacket, as red and lustrous as a dog's erection. It did well to insulate me against the evening chill. Because Julie couldn't make it that night, leadership reverted to Josh, who wanted to head north into Harlem. Quote, "It's a neighborhood that needs us," end quote, he said. He turned to me, quote, "Assuming you're up to it, assuming you're up for the fun," end quote. I nodded, but before we could move out, an older woman approached us and addressed Josh as though he were Slewa. Quote, "I don't remember you being so short, Curtis," end quote, she said. Quote, "Curtis is not short," end quote, Casey corrected her. Quote, "He is not. He is 6 feet tall," end quote. Quote, "It's good to see you anyway, Curtis," the lady said. She smiled and took a long drag from the cigarette's holder between her fingers. "Today is my birthday," she added. "I would like to donate money to you," quote. Josh told her that we couldn't accept cash on behalf of the organization, but if she went to the Angels website, she'd find instructions on how to make a charitable donation. To get to Harlem, we could take the number one train to 96th Street and walk from there. Josh ordered me to stick with Jeff, who'd teach me how to patrol in a subway car. Quote, "You'll love it," end quote, Josh assured me. Quote, "You'll love Harlem. Harlem loves us," end quote. Then he mock whispered, quote, "Don't worry, you'll have Jeff with you," end quote. Quote, "Why shouldn't we worry?" Jeff wanted to know. "Because I'm black? Maybe he should worry," end quote. Our presence did not deter three teens from jumping the subway turnstiles. We did nothing about it because the MTA employees 5 feet away did nothing about it. We deferred to their professional indifference. Then we made for our train. To be completed next week.